from the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me. Our guest today is Dr. Lee Neumeier, chair of the Department of Surgery at the University of Arizona, an internationally recognized breast cancer surgeon and researcher, and a distinguished surgical educator. Dr. Neumeier has long been a dedicated advocate for women's health issues. In 2010, she published the book, Meet Virginia, Biography of a Breast, which chronicles a patient's journey through her breast cancer surgery and serves as an educational resource for newly diagnosed breast cancer patients. We're very honored to welcome you to the University of Wisconsin in The Surgery Set, Dr. Neumeier, and we really enjoyed your grand rounds talking about surgical education and sort of the future of the American general surgeon.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back here in Madison. I always enjoy coming and seeing all my friends.
Your talk, which is available online at the Department of Surgery website, really focused on how general surgeons, you know, have historically been trained, and then you obviously, as a member of the college and as a sort of leading thinker in education of surgeons, have some perspectives on how we're transitioning from that old model into this new future of general surgery training. I wonder if you could sort of recap for us what the, you know, what the old model was and talk to us a little bit about what you think the new model is going to be.
Sure. So I think this is important. I think there were a couple of major changes in American surgery over the last little bit that as we were training residents, we didn't really transition with the times, if you will. So the first one was actually not the resident work hours. That's the second one. But the first one was as we transitioned from fully inpatient work to having some outpatient work. So that meant that a lot of the decision making is made in clinic. The patients come in the morning of surgery and then they go home either the same day or shortly thereafter. And that didn't allow us to have the time. You know, I remember as a medical student, I was hired by a local ophthalmologist to go out to the place where he did cataract surgery. And I'd go out on the evening, Tuesday and Wednesday nights, and do 5 or 6 H&Ps. So the patients for a cataract procedure were admitted the night before. Very convenient for the doctor, right? Okay for the patient. They didn't mind being in the hospital the night before. Probably not so good for the system because of the expense. And we certainly had the capacity then to do it. We had enough hospital beds and things like that. As a medical student, you know, I had a lot of opportunities to interact with the patients. As a resident, same thing, because they'd be in the hospital for a long time. Now those patients aren't in the hospital, so we've lost that opportunity. So I really felt like as that transitioning was happening, and that I would say mostly happened in the 90s, that we lost an opportunity by not transitioning how we were training medical students and residents. And I don't think we've still transitioned that very well. I don't know about here at the University of Wisconsin, but certainly at Utah and now at Arizona, that priority is always put by the surgery residents on coming to the cases, right? I'm going to cover your case. If you want to get me really angry, tell me you're going to cover my case. Because it's not just about the operation, right? It's about all the judgment and things that go into it beforehand. And certainly in the specialty that I practice, the majority of that judgment and counseling of the patient goes on in the clinic. And so I really get feel like you need to have come to clinic, because the other thing is nobody likes doing, well, I don't like doing charts, okay? And if I'm going to do all that work in clinic and then you're just going to show up for the fun part, the case, I get kind of angry. But I think we had that opportunity to transition. We're still struggling with that in most residencies and even in medical schools. I noticed that the curriculum here is going through a transformation. We're going to do something similar at Arizona. And it's like, how do you really get the continuity? So the medical student, we have them for 3 weeks on each rotation. We only have 6 weeks of them on surgery. And how do they really get the gestalt of what goes on with the patient? The second thing was a work hours restriction, right? So in the past, we relied on the immersion therapy. In my day, when we were doing every other night call, you know, there's only one problem with that.
Do you want the problem?
Miss half the cases, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I was easily working 100, 120 hours a week. I didn't mind it. I love what I do. But, you know, it was just kind of catch what catch can. And, you know, I can tell you, for instance, on pediatric surgery. So my husband and I were the same year in residency. And his experience on pediatric surgery, he saw a whole bunch of gastroschisis and omphaloceles and not a single esophageal atresia. And I saw no omphaloceles or gastroschisis. And I saw like every type of esophageal atresia and TE fistulas and things like that. So, you know, how do you balance that out? Well, you're supposed to do it with reading. But I think now when we don't have residents in for 100, 120 hours, we've got to figure out and be way more deliberate with what we're teaching them and also define the product that we want.
Yeah, I think I mean, you did some simple math about just the number of hours that residents used to work at 100 hours a week in 5 years. It was like 24,000 hours of practice. Yeah. But you make the point that that wasn't deliberate practice, right? That it was just a pure immersion technique. And I think one thing that I've sort of been struck by as I've sort of come up within the 80-hour work week is that trying to sort of fit that immersion practice into a restricted time is where there seems to be a lot of conflict. And you make a lot of points about the value of deliberate practice.
Right.
How do you see that sort of playing out in training?
Well, I think it plays out in a lot of ways. Number one is simulation. So I have a lot of gray hair that's currently covered with I have a great colorist, you know, only my hairdresser knows. But that gray hair, I believe, came from taking residents through their first lap coli, right? It's very scary. And we had this discussion last week at the American College of Surgeons where in the olden days, you can manage almost any oops with your hand. Right? If you got the belly open, you can put your hand in there. You can put, just like they were saying for the kidney, you know, put two sponge sticks on. If you're in the laparoscope, your ability to control that is a little bit less. Now, you can do it, and there's some techniques to do it, but it's less. So I think what we've got to do is start thinking about the steps of the operation, break things down into steps, give immediate feedback. Okay, you did really well with how you're managing the Bovi, you know, the hook in this lap coli, but maybe if you set yourself up a little bit differently, your exposure would have been better, things like that immediately after the case. And that's where those performance assessments that the board has put together can help us, right? Because it provides us a framework as faculty in how can we give feedback to this resident. Which of these steps were they missing on? We may not have been able to pull it out of our brains as we were watching it, but when you go through this form, you can say, okay, where are they doing this? What are the anchors? Can I put them in the middle, at the top, or at the bottom on this metric?
Yeah, I think one of the attendings who I really enjoyed operating with as a resident always said as we were scrubbing for the case, she's like, what one thing do you want to learn?
Yes.
Or practice in this case. And then she would focus on that one thing. And then at the end of the case, we would talk about that one thing.
Yep.
And then even as a junior resident, it became a targetable skill, even
exactly.
In a complex case that I could never sort of understand, like beginning to end, in the early part of my training.
And so what we really need, and one of the things that came out of this conference last week, every residency program is supposed to undergo an internal review for ACGME, right? And I got reviews back on three of my residency programs at the University of Arizona. And all three had the same comment, which was greater than 85% of the faculty didn't feel equipped to do the teaching that they needed to do. And it's just like the survey we did. We had three people in the audience who had either a teaching certificate to like teach grade school or high school, or had an advanced degree in education. So we need to figure it out. And that came through loud and clear from this multi-specialty conference last week at the college, that faculty development is critical to using this time effectively for our trainees and producing. Once we define the product, then we've got to train the trainers. And it's interesting. I just pulled out a book that was published in 1991 by Neil Whitman, who's a PhD educator, and a guy named Peter Lawrence, who's a vascular surgeon, now chief of vascular at UCLA. And they were both at the University of Utah. And it's something called like surgical teaching surgery or something like that. And it really talks about the fact that each one of us is actually a pretty good teacher. And we're a pretty good teacher because we have to learn those skills as we interact one-on-one with our patients. But for some reason, while we can be very dictatorial to your patients, you know, most patients like it if it's more cooperation, combined decision making. Once we get to teach residents, for some reason, you know, surgery is kind of an ego boosting field, and we kind of need to play the game of guess what I'm thinking. And, you know, it's easier for me to answer the question. So I'm going to ask you a question where I know the answer, even though I'm trying to ask it as open ended. You know, it looks better for me if I know the answer. So there's so many things. So this book was written, 25 years ago now?
Yeah.
And every single thing in it is entirely appropriate now. So it was really fun to go back and read that. And I think there's so many of those things that we need to take into account. We have adult learners. So you're fresh out of your residency. Were there ever any times in your residency where you felt like you were being treated like a child by your attendings?
Oh, constantly.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And it's like, this is crazy. Okay, this is like super crazy, right? They graduated college where they had to be an adult learner, right?
Mm-hmm.
They graduated medical school where you definitely had to be an adult learner. And now they're residents. So the average age of our residents, I'm going to guess, is somewhere in the late 20s, early 30s.
Right, sure.
And we treat them like children.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. So, you know, I think as attendings, we've got to kind of have a mind shift here and really a paradigm shift in how we're thinking. These are adults. These are our partners. And it's in our best interest to get our residents trained really well, because who's going to take care of me?
Right.
I hope to never have to undergo the knife. So, you know, I think that we need to make sure we're training them well and utilizing the time that we have. And I remember being in the early 90s, being on a panel with Jordan Cohen, and he was the head of the AAMC at the time.
Right.
He said, you know, I just can't believe you surgeons that you can't train a good general surgeon when you have them for 80 hours a week for 5 years. Why is that, that you can't do that?
Yeah.
He said, the math just doesn't make sense. And I agree with them.
Yeah. I mean, you postulate in your talk that one model for the future for general surgery would be to train general surgeons in 3 or 4 years,
yep,
incorporating 40 hours a week of deliberate practice,
yep,
and then have them go out, do some general surgery as part of a health service corps, or really understand what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then go in for their specialty training. And I think that that's a compelling model. Yeah.
Well, it really is, because, you know, once you've struggled on your own, you know, one of the fun things I did, and I'd like to see a way that we could do this in the country, is when I was, it was the early 2000s, and it was clear that something in my life needed to change, because I was exhausted. I was taking 10 nights a call at the VA, 5 nights at the university on trauma, not overlapping. I had 3 kids under the age of 5. I had a husband who was a cardiothoracic surgeon. I was running the VA hernia trial. I'd just given up being chief of surgery, and I was like, something in my life's got to change, because this is just, and I was traveling about 60 days a year.
Unbelievable.
And for business, not for vacation.
Ugh.
So I started to think about, well, I think I need to narrow my practice, you know, because I started to get really concerned. And something we don't talk about a lot is the stress that it is of being a surgeon. And, you know, when my patients don't do well, I take it very personally. And I think most surgeons do.
Yeah.
And so I started to think about, how could I narrow my practice such that I would still be challenged technically and also intellectually? So I thought, well, I'm going to be a breast and endocrine surgeon. So I still had an active California license. So I thought, well, I'm going to go out and do a little bit of buffing up on my thyroid and parathyroid skills by hanging out with Orlo Clark for a couple of weeks. So I emailed him. I said, I'd like to come. You can credential me, bill for my services. My malpractice will be covered by my home institution. I just want to come hang out. I won't move anywhere, but I want to scrub. I want to scrub on cases. I want to just like be glued to your side.
Yeah.
And I learned so much in those 2 weeks. Even though I wasn't doing the cases, it was just that I had struggled. You know, I'd had my own things, and I learned a lot, and it was great. And if we could provide those opportunities for surgeons, both for surgeons to come in and learn a new skill, but then also for master surgeons to go out and watch you in your own environment. We found that in NISQIP, part of the problem was that you take a surgeon out of San Francisco and plop them in Augusta, Maine, and they're trying to do the same things in Augusta that they did in San Francisco. Well, if you don't have a interventional radiologist available, if you don't have, you know, lots of different things, you probably shouldn't be doing those big procedures.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot we can learn by adding in some different things and making it not be remediation, making it be the norm.
Right. And tailoring people's training to the practices that they're
absolutely
planning to do.
And then make it be normal that about every 5 or 10 years you go back in for retraining.
Yeah.
I mean, think about the 2 pilots that flew the 2 planes I was on, right?
Yeah.
You know, they retrain every 6 months and they get checked off on competency. It's just amazing that we've gotten by with what we've gotten by with for so many years.
Yeah.
The good news is, for the most part, it works. But we all know there's times when it hasn't worked so well.
Yeah. I think it's an exciting future that you paint for surgical training and what we have.
Lots of opportunities. Lots of opportunities.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time with us today and for your Grand Rounds talk that's available on the website. And we really look forward to hearing what you have to say this afternoon as part of our retreat. And then we hope to see you back in Wisconsin very soon.
I'm only coming now in the summer.
That's a very wise choice. Thank you so much.
All right.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Join us next time as we talk with Dr. James Cole. He's a former Navy medical officer and current trauma medical director at Swedish American Hospital in Rockford, Illinois, one of UW's affiliates. Dr. Cole will discuss some of the incredible medical advancements that have occurred over the course of history as a result of war, and will also speak on some of his personal experiences in the military and how his time in the service has shaped who he is today. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Whisk Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon.